Our sponsors this week are Urban Services Limited. With over 12 years' experience in delivering well-crafted maintenance solutions, including loft and annex conversions, roofs, and complete modernisation in London and the surrounding counties, and on top of that, providing scaffolding throughout the UK for homes, schools, offices, and specialist telecommunications scaffolding, Urban Services Limited deliver the results you need to the highest calibre. Go to urbanservices.limited to find out more. Welcome to episode 87. Before I tell you about this week's guest, I have some big, gigantic, juicy podcast news. After two onstage shows down in lovely Brighton, I am now bringing the love to London with ongoing live podcasts at the Comedy Store in Leicester Square. Already on sale are tickets for Matthew Holness in character as Garth Marenghi on December the 20th, and early next year, confirmed shows with Harry Ray Bloody Purchase Peacock from Toast of London, Star Stories Kevin Bishop, and Matt King and Izzy Sooty, aka Superhands and Dobby from Peep Show. And there are more in the pipeline, and probably some music ones at other venues too. Tickets for December 20th can be found via a link on my website realfeedback.co.uk or by having a little search around on the Comedy Store website itself. Now, John Mark Lapham, or Oldfire, has a new album out on November the 4th called Voids. Its sound is described as dream pop, filmic ambient, raga-like drones, avant country, and even spiritual jazz. I agree and disagree entirely, as it's an album so diverse in genre, it's hard to pigeonhole in any way. It's one that, for me, delivers new joys on every listen. I highly recommend it. I spoke to John Mark, who, with the time difference in Texas where he lives, was up and ready for me at 6 a.m. Top bloke, good chat. Also, stick around to the end to hear Window Without a World featuring Julia Holter, which is the song I've been waffling over for the last 2 minutes. This isn't an interview. This is a conversation. This is Real Feedback. Am I right in saying it's 6 a.m. at the moment?
It's 6 a.m.
And this was by choice, wasn't it, that you...
I didn't have many options, let's just say.
Okay. Are you 3 minutes from bed, or are you up and you've eaten? And
About 40 minutes.
All right, okay. Because when I got the... Because first of all, they asked me to do 11 a.m., which is an hour ago, and I didn't know you were only 6 hours behind, so I thought this was going to be a post-recording session, middle of the night. Okay, but no, it's the early bird session, so...
Yeah. I've got a stacked schedule today, so this is the only time I could do it.
Has it been like that for a while now? Because obviously it's a week and a day, and is it next Friday the album's out?
I think it's next Friday,
yeah. If that's the 4th. So are you in Texas? I know that's quite a large place. So whereabouts precisely are you?
I live in Abilene, Texas, which is considered West Texas, but it's pretty much right in the middle of the state.
And has that been your whole life? You were born and raised, or you've moved there?
I was not born here. I was born in the south part of Texas, kind of on the border of Mexico almost.
Right.
I grew up here, but then I lived in England for 12 years.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I used to live in Manchester.
Oh, okay. Was that when you were a child, or?
No, that's when I was, I think I moved over there when I was in my early 20s. I went to school in Manchester for sound recording.
Right. So,
yeah.
And why, I don't know why you wouldn't want to stay in England, and you know.
Something kept me coming back for 12 years.
So. Yeah. Oh, so you know the Brits quite well then. That's nice.
I do. I'm going to be back over there in a couple of weeks as well.
Oh, are you? Is that for touring purposes?
No, just for vacation. I've been meaning to go back for the last few years. I actually planned to go back right before the pandemic started. And that fell through, of course. It's just been something I've been wanting to do for a while. I feel like I should do it now while I can, while things are looking okay for travel.
People are still catching up, aren't they? It's incredible.
Yeah.
Even though it now kind of just feels like a bad fever dream almost, but the knock-on effects are still very much there. Will that be going back to Manchester, your old haunting grounds, or a bit of a tour around the country?
Just mostly London and Manchester. Yeah. I spent a lot of time in both cities while I was living there. So I just want to kind of catch up with friends and kind of see the area again, reconnect.
Yeah, because I noticed one of your collaborators on this album, Bill Callahan, he's actually touring next week. So he's in London, I think Wednesday or Thursday next week.
Yeah,
he's got a tour going on. So the album, it's one of the most eclectic mix, and this is a compliment, mix of genres and styles and emotions as well, because you might get an album that's generally quite angry or quite somber or quite melancholy or quite chilled, but this kind of weaves in and out of, from my perspective as a listener, songs of kind of great sadness, but also celestial. You know, I mean, it's was it always your intention to have this mixed bag? That's a terrible analogy for what this album is, because it deserves better, but of styles and sounds.
I think a little bit of both. I didn't, when I first set out to start recording the album, I didn't have a really set plan of like, okay, this is going to be super diverse and I'm going to do this and this and this. But I kind of also knew that I have a lot of influences, and I knew that a lot of those influences would end up on the album. And I also purposely wanted to break out of any sort of mold that I might have made for myself on the first album. I feel like I had a lot of restrictions on the first album. Like, I had a very specific sound I wanted to make, and I kind of stayed within these confines for the first album, which I at the time liked that. I thought it worked well. It focused my mind a little bit, and part of it's just a natural product of working with different people as well, and sort of letting their contributions shine through. And then part of it is just really wanting to, like I say, just try new things and just sort of try and take these disparate elements and make them all sort of hang together in a certain way.
Because I just wanted to mention, now you brought up the first album, that you've got a cover of Laserbeam by Low on there, and I love Low, and I've never heard anyone, I'm sure they have, but I've never heard anyone cover them before. So when I found that, it was an extra, because particularly years ago, they were a very big, important band to me. And that sort of, that song, so because someone gave me a CD and said, listen to this. This is the band called Low. And it was all different songs from different albums, Starfire and Dinosaur Act and all this. And Laserbeam obviously was on there. And what you do with it is really, really interesting. And so I just wonder, just out of curiosity for myself, why you picked that song to go on your first album. Was it just you were a fan, or you felt the content of lyrically was apt?
I think it's a lot of things. I don't know Low, like I don't know their whole back catalog really well. Kind of like you, the first time I heard the song was a long time ago, but it was through a compilation a friend of mine made me in Manchester, actually. And that was my favorite song on the compilation. And it's just something that I had in my head for a long time. Like I've always loved that song. It wasn't like I always had this plan of covering it one day. It's just that as I was putting that album together, I was looking for covers to include on it. And I heard that song, and it's a lot of it's the lyrical content and just the beauty of that song. I wanted to reinterpret it for our album. But I also knew that I had the people that I worked with. I had the right people to do it. Like, I would never try and take on a song like that if I didn't feel like I had the right people behind it and that I had something to give it. I didn't want to do it just for the sake of doing it. So I had like the vocalists and I had the musicians and I had the ideas for it. So, and it was just the right timing. Like I was, searching for songs at that time. And I actually listened to that compilation that my friend gave me years and years ago. And I was like, oh man, this would be perfect. So yeah, it was just the right timing for it. Yeah.
So regarding the collaborative effort with your music, what was it? There must have been a time when you decided, okay, I'm not going to form a band that will play these songs I want to write. I want to work with, a ton of different people. Was the thinking behind that just because you knew the music would be so diverse that it kind of warranted some diverse musicians and stuff? Or, I mean, what was the, do you see it more as a project rather than a band? Because obviously people usually pick a few of their mates or whatever and there you go. We write some songs and go out on the road.
It was just always what I wanted. Ever since I've wanted to record music, I've always wanted to have this sort of project where, I mean, specifically since I've been making music, I've met so many musicians. I mean, I was in a band in the early 2000s called the Earlies. And through the Earlies, and then through my next project after that was called the Late Chord. Beyond that, I was in another band called Revival Hour. And just through all these different projects, I've met so many musicians that I really respect and love what they do. And I myself, I'm more of a producer than a musician. I sit at my computer and I sample a lot and I program, I put things together. But I'm not really interested in just like making an actual solo album. Like I'm not interested in just like what I would do, because it would just be, I want things that are more organic, I guess, in a lot of ways, and diverse sounding. And I would get really bored listening to what I would do myself. So I love the idea of working with all these different musicians. You know, it's like an excuse to bring them in and have them do something. Because it almost feels like a waste if I didn't sort of explore these relationships I have with these different people and try to get them together, you know, because I know people here in Texas, and then I know people in England, so like, and different places as well. And so it just feels like an opportunity to bring all these people together. I mean, most of them I've never met, you know, I'm just from so different locations that it's just a nice way to bring them together, because I know what each of them can do. And then it kind of ends up with me in my lap, and then I do my thing, you know, and it starts with my thing, and then I send it to them, and then it comes back to me, and then I do my thing again, and then put it all together here. So yeah, it's just, that's what I wanted to do from the very beginning. And so it's just sort of realizing all these different inspirations that I have, and yeah, just seeing it through.
That's really interesting, because I had a band years ago and we split up 15 years ago. We got back together last year and we just recorded an album. And the way I write is that I write songs that I'd want to hear a band play, you know, on the radio thing. So kind of like what you said, except with me being in the band, when I listen back to it, I like listening to it, obviously, but oh, it's me again. But when you listen back to it, you kind of get that slightly impartial, as invested in the project that, as you are, you kind of get that impartial side of things, because you've got these guest singers and guest musicians on there. So you mm-hmm. kind of get the best of both worlds, which is great. When you do the track listing for Voids, is there a plan to that? Because it ends with the four Voids, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Was it always a plan to have this kind of four-part instrumental section at the end, or do you write and you go, okay, this one, I don't want words on this song. It's become apparent that it's going to be its own thing. Yeah. How does the actual structure of the album fit? Because you've got, like you say, you program stuff and you sample stuff, but you've also got very organic instrument sounds in there as well. Mm-hmm. And just weaving one to the other. So it's quite incredible how it all works. So how difficult was that to put together?
It wasn't very difficult. I think when I started this second album, I envisioned there being more vocal tracks on one side and instrumental tracks on the other. I've always seen it as a record, just because I love vinyl. So I'm always picturing it like as an A side and a B side. I'm a big fan of David Bowie's Low album, and I love how there's the vocal side and the instrumental side of that. I wasn't too strict about like, well, this is definitely all got to be vocals over here, and this is all got to be instrumentals. It was a little more organic than that. I was kind of open to seeing how it went, but I think that was my initial idea, is that there was going to be mostly vocals on one area, mostly instrumentals, and it just kind of worked out. It just kind of all ended up that way. The whole Void suite, like the second half of it, it was very organic the way that came together. I had recorded a lot of material I was working on a remix project before I started the album, And so I had a lot of my musician friends, like I sent them the source. Well, I sent them a few things like to play on, and they improvise tons and tons of tracks. So I had lots and lots of raw audio to play with. And the first thing that I recorded for this album was the first part of the Void Suite, which is called Uninvited. And that sort of like informed the whole rest of the album. Like, cause I had, like an hour of steel guitar, from that remix I'd been working on, and the remix never materialized. I finished it, but it never came out. So I was left with all this material. So I wanted to do something with it. So I took all that steel guitar and started, turning it into a song on its own, which is what turned out to be Uninvited. And I had so much of that material that it just, there was, yeah, I could have made a whole album's worth. Just yeah.
Well, that's the longest track on the album, isn't it? That's 8 minutes, over 8:22, I think it was. So, because you've got three songs with Bill Callahan, and two of them are next to each other. And mm-hmm. and it kind of, I find it really hard to describe how this album makes me feel, but it's all in a good way, because there's certain albums that you hear and you nod along in the car. But I knew when I first heard this album that I would feel differently on the 10th listen than I would on the first. And I did. And it is one of those discover more every time you listen to it albums. And most artists don't like to be pigeonholed, but I can hear sort of, certain tracks have got Nick Cave, Warren Ellis film score elements to them. And I can hear some Beck in there, which in the Adam Torres, is that how you pronounce his name? In Dreamless, and the sort of dissonant strings in the background and stuff. And so when you mentioned about being a sound engineer in Manchester, was that where the sort of programming, I don't want to say film score style, but you know, the instrumental style, like Void, where that came in, or were you always into that sort of experimental side of music? Because people generally either pick up a guitar and, you know, I'm simplifying, but people pick up a guitar and write songs on that and a piano, or they do this, you know, out there, and you kind of are all over all of it. So was there sections where you were in a band like the earlies where it would just be four chords and singing? When did it change?
I think it was mostly always there. I've always really been into ambient music, which is also sort of includes film soundtracks and classical music and other things. But I've always been into experimental music as well. And I think what I brought to the earlies was a lot of the sort of production sound of it. Like I wasn't doing the same thing for the earlies, but I was definitely kind of pulling from the same well and the same influences. But it was probably after the earlies, when I went into my next project, The Late Chord, I started exploring sort of more atmospheric ambient sound after that. And then, yeah, I think as I've been going along, I've been definitely progressing more in that area. But I've always been more interested in sort of not traditional pop structures, just more like sound and textures and the production side of things. That's always excited me most about producing music.
So when you just take When I Was In My Prime, which is the first track on there with Bill Callahan, what do you send him? Is it a fully finished? Do you invite them to add their own lyrics? Do you invite them to add their own melody? If they're a singer, if they're depending on what sort of instrumentalist they are, how collaborative is each song?
It's a very collaborative process. I did not send him what you hear at all. I think when we first broached this song, man, it's everything that I work on, regardless of what it is, it changes so dramatically from the very first idea to what it ends up being. Like, it's so unpredictable. Like for this track, I started, so my influence for this song was a Nina Simone track. She did a cover of When I Was In My Prime. I just randomly, I bought one of her albums and heard her version, and it really, really blew me away. I'd never heard it before. So I was like, this is what I want on this album. Like, I want this mood, and the lyrics were amazing. Her performance was amazing. Everything about it was amazing. So I was kind of initially thinking like I might do something kind of like this, like it's just a guitar and her vocal, and that's pretty much it on that, on her version. And then I started toying with it and building up sounds. And obviously, and as is always the case, it just changed. It started changing from that original idea of doing something similar to what she did into something totally different, really vast and droney. And then I, for a very long time, I was looking for a vocalist, and I was trying to find the right voice to sing the song. And I originally thought it would be a woman's voice. So I was searching for female vocalists. And I reached out to a few people, but I didn't find anyone who was right, who also had the time and willingness to do it. So I kept looking. And then as I was looking, I was working on it. So it was changing more. And then I met Bill through a mutual friend. And when he came on board, I think I was at a point where I was like, okay, I'm just going to not necessarily start from scratch, but I'm just going to be open to this song going any direction that it needs to go. Like if we need to start over, we can start over or whatever. Or maybe I can bring in elements from my old ideas later. And he performed it, just him singing with an acoustic guitar. So I started thinking, okay, that's the way it's going to go. It's going to be more of a traditional folk song. So I started building on that arrangement, and it just didn't feel like old fire. Like it wasn't really gelling with anything that I had been working on or really any of the sort of textures from the album. So I basically just took his vocal and started working with my friend Thor Harris, who is the one that introduced Bill and I, and just completely scrapped everything and started over with what you hear on the finished recording, which is this droning hurdy-gurdy sound. And then I started working with other musicians for the whole, there's a whole instrumental sort of section that comes after Bill finishes singing that kind of came at the end. And I started working with musicians, on that part. And yeah, it was very unpredictable and very much unlike anything I actually thought it might sound like, which I think is for the better for that
well, track. It's interesting because you say you were looking for a female vocalist, and not only is Bill obviously not a female vocalist, but he's a baritone vocalist.
Yeah.
So it's like the polar opposite, and it's funny how you discover that. So do you have moments where people send stuff back to you and you have to say to them, I don't think this is going to work? I mean, are they happy to for you to edit and say, I'm not using that, I'm going to use that?
I don't know if I'd say happy.
Because it must be really tough for you to go, is this right? I mean, I don't even know how you edit yourself to decide if this change that someone has suggested. Because if I take a song to the band I'm in and they suggest something and I don't immediately feel it's right, I don't know whether to, I'll just record it, you know, demo it and keep listening to it and make a decision. But it's hard. We go, is this right for my song, or should I scrap it?
Yeah, there's a lot of scrapping going on throughout the whole process. Luckily, like everyone I work with, there's no ego involved, and they're usually pretty open towards my ideas. And I try to tell people at the beginning, whenever we start working together, that my whole process usually involves lots of different drafts and lots of restarts, just to get where it needs to be. And it usually works pretty well that way. I think there's a couple of instances on the album, like with Adam Torres, which is, this is kind of rare, but where I have the instrumental backing more or less together, and then they just come in and put their vocal on it. That's very rare. That's the way it happened with Adam. I sent him, it wasn't completely finished, but we had the verses and the choruses laid out, and it was pretty much that same structure. So he just came in and kind of laid his vocal over. And luckily it just, the flow of the song worked perfectly with what he was doing. And we didn't have to go in and rearrange or anything or change anything. It just slotted in perfectly, which is, like I say, super rare. But I like that with you know, when I'm working on this music, like when it just sort of all clicks. And I love being surprised by what we're doing. Like when I listen, there's a couple of tracks on the album that I'm really surprised by, like that Dreamless and then the Julia Holter song Window Without a World. Those two are like my biggest surprises on the album because they kind of both kind of came out of nowhere, seemingly came out of nowhere. Like they came together really quickly and they don't sound, neither one of them sound like something I would have planned to record. They just happened and then they were right because they were what they were. But they were, total surprises for me. And I love those moments.
Because the album is about 5 years in the making, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And is that because obviously COVID again has a lot of, although a lot of the people I've spoken to, it almost upped the creativity because you can obviously work remotely, which is by the sound of what you mainly do. So was there a reason why it took so long? I mean, how long did Songs from the Haunted South take to come together and record? Was that a similar?
No, I mean that period. That album actually took me 10 years, but I wasn't like working on it straight for 10 years. I started ideas from it like way back when I was almost in the early still, but a little bit like when I was working on my late chord project after the earlys that I,
getting faster then. So that's good.
Getting past, I'm half the time. Yeah. But yeah, it was a lot of like dipping back in and back and forth over a period of 10 years. So it wasn't like I was in the studio for 10 years working on it. And kind of the same for Voids. Like I wasn't working on it straight for 5 years. I'm in another band called Mean. And we recorded an album in the last 5 years. And I'm a video producer. So I've been doing video things in this last 5 years, but with Old Fire, it was just sort of a matter of whenever I'm able to work on it and whenever I'm able to get the musicians and get them recording on it. And so there's a lot of, often, you know, big stretch of the time where I'm waiting for them to bring me stuff back, or I'm working on another project and I come back to it. And a lot of times, a lot of these songs, like I said before, kind of, you know, I worked on them ages and then built them up and then realized like they weren't right or for whatever reason. So kind of started over again. So yeah, it's a long process. The pandemic definitely had an effect on that obviously, but, the album's been done for over a year now, about a year and a half. So it's just been a matter of waiting to get it mixed, mastered, and then just like waiting for the schedule, for the label, for it to be the right time for them to release it as well. So,
The vinyl now takes forever. I don't know if it's the same in America, but over here we looked at vinyl for our album and there was a sort of a 7 month lead time. I think when the story is apparently when vinyl took a huge dip, that two main companies bought the machines in, and they're in Norway or somewhere in Scandinavia or something. And so it kind of all these albums get funneled into this one or two companies. So the lead time on it is crazy. And then if someone like Adele releases an album where they're going to be pressing 15 million, then you're just back of the queue. So, there's all these reasons. Do you ever get to, do you play live with these, are you going to tour the album? And if so, do you use the same musicians that feature on the album? Scheduling must be a nightmare.
Yeah. Old Fire, I've always considered to be a studio project. There's never been a plan to do anything live. I'm a little open to it if the stars align, but I don't think it's ever going to be happen, to be honest, because like you said, I mean, everyone that I work with is spread out over such a vast distance, and sort of rehearsing and finding everyone with an open schedule who can dedicate the time to it. And I think logistically it would be near impossible. And I don't really have a burning passion to tour. Like it'd be nice if we could do a couple of shows, like a couple of key places like London and New York and one in Austin. Cause the label that I'm on is in Austin. And Bill lives in Austin and Thor lives in Austin. So that would be a good place to do it. But those guys are pretty busy. I stay busy with stuff. So I don't think it's in the cards, okay. But Never say never.
Never, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how about a launch party for the album next week? Have you got Bill and Thor coming over for a couple of drinks to celebrate?
That would be nice. No, Bill's on tour, and
of course, Bill he'll be in the UK, won't he? Yeah.
Yeah, I can't keep up with Thor. He's always doing something. So we thought about possibly doing some sort of release party. We haven't talked about it in a while, so I'm pretty sure it's not happening.
I mean, it must feel very strange. You say the album's been ready for a year and a half, that in a week's time, well, 8 days' time, whoever wants to hear it can hear it. It can be anyone, absolutely anywhere.
Yeah, it's a little weird. It's sort of a relief as well, you know, because it just feels like something that's been gestating for so long, and it's taking up a lot of my, you know, my processing power. Even now, just thinking about it and making sure everything's ready and doing all these, you know, things around the release of the album, like, it's nice to think, yes, this will be out and I can move on and think about other things.
And hopefully maybe 2 years, 3 years for the next one.
Okay. That would be great.
Yeah.
That would be great. Yeah, I have like some material. I've been working on a few variations on songs from Voids and some new material already. So I don't think it's going to be very long before something else comes out.
Well, I personally should very much look forward to that. And I wish you all the best with the album. Voids is out on the 4th of November on Western Vinyl. And I hope everything goes absolutely amazingly for you.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Cheers. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.